everybody, to the next installment in our AIFS webinar series. Today's topic will be around promoting social connectedness to support men's health. My name is Sean Martin. I'm the program lead here at the 10 to Men study. For those of you who aren't aware, the 10 to Men study is Australia's longitudinal study of male health and wellbeing, and we'll be talking about some of our research this afternoon. Before we get too deep into proceedings, though, I'd just like to start by acknowledging that I'm speaking to you from the lands of the Kaurna people. I acknowledge the Kaurna people and their descendants as traditional owners of this land. I pay my respects to their elders, both past, present, and emerging, and invite you all to do the same from wherever you're joining us today. So as I mentioned, today's topic today is around social connectedness and ways we can use that to improve men's health. To do that, we've pulled together a panel that encompasses people from research, clinical practice, and the community. And in terms of just a general overview of what we'll be covering today, we'll start with the what's and where's, I guess, of social connectedness and why we think it's particularly important. We'll then move on to talk about some strategies to better engage men who may be socially disconnected. And then we want to finish off by talking about the impact and the implications of social connectedness for future research and clinical practice. Most importantly, from our point of view, we'll also finish with a Q&A session for about 15 or 20 minutes where we want to hear from you, our audience members, for questions you might have. So I'll now introduce our panel today. I'm going to start with Dr. Brendan Quinn. Brendan is a research fellow here at AIFS and a colleague of mine in the 10 to Men study. So welcome to you, Brendan.
Thanks, Sean.
Dr. Ian Zajac is a friend and colleague of some 15 years, but he also, particularly for today, has some expertise around men's health research, particularly around male type depression. He also wears another hat as a clinical psychologist, operating his own practice at Men's Psychology Service out of Adelaide. So welcome to you, Ian.
Thanks, Sean.
All right. And finally, we're very happy today to have with us a representative from the Men's Shed Associations of Australia, Peter Torenbeek. Peter is the president of the CESNOC Men's Shed Association, but he's also someone who I'm reliably told is very well known in CESNOC. He started a career in banking and since retirement has dedicated his time to volunteering across disability, senior sector and aged care sectors as well. So welcome to you today, Peter.
Good afternoon, Sean, and thank you.
Great to have you. And also, I should thank all of you, our audience today, for joining us today for today's conversations. So let's get to the meat and potatoes of today's chosen topics. And I thought we'd start off by talking about, well, what do we mean when we talk about social connectedness and why we think being socially connected is so important. So Brendan, can I start out with you, mate? Can you start out by talking to us about how you define social connectedness in your recent 10 to Men report and take us through some of the main findings from that work?
Sure thing. Thank you, Sean. Before I jump into that, I should briefly mention that the entire 10 to Men report is available on the 10 to Men website and as a handout for this webinar. So if it seems like we're rushing through the findings or if you just want some more information, the report is easily available through both of those avenues. I also need to note that the data that we collected for the 10 to Men study that we'll be talking about today was collected before COVID. So this just needs to be considered when we're chatting today with regard to interpretation of our findings on social connectedness. But I guess firstly, reflecting on how I guess we conceptualize social connectedness for the report, we define this overarching theme as comprising three core domains. The first was of those was self-perceived social support, which relates to someone's subjective or personal beliefs about the availability of or accessibility of tangible, emotional and positive social interactions and support systems and networks. The second was attachment relationships, which refers to the number and the quality of the connections that we have with our family members and our friends and the people that we live and work with and interact with regularly. And the third is community integration, which relates to the extent that we're involved in our community, surprisingly enough. But more specifically, this refers to our employment status and participation in various community-based activities, such as religious communities, sporting teams, volunteering, and you know, various hobby groups as well. Just to touch briefly on why social connectedness is important, it's generally speaking because it's good for us. It's good for our health and our well-being and for preventing negative health outcomes. For example, having low levels of social connectedness has been associated with the development of various issues such as cardiovascular disease, obesity, and sleep problems. In terms of mental health and risk behaviours, low levels of social connectedness have been associated with the experience of depressive symptoms, harmful use of alcohol and other substances, personality disorder, and also suicidality. And it's good that we're focusing today's discussion on Aussie males because men can be less socially connected than women. For example, research has pointed to higher levels of loneliness among Aussie men compared to women, and women are sometimes more integrated in the community. For example, they're sometimes more likely to volunteer than men. In terms of some of our main findings that came out of the report, they pointed to certain subgroups of Aussie males who are possibly more socially disconnected than others. For example, we found that those with lower levels of self-perceived social support were more likely to be older. So we have to be mindful of the possibility of reduced social connectedness as we age. But they're also more likely to be unemployed, to be living in more remote areas of the country, to live alone, to identify as non-heterosexual, and to be single fathers. And it's worth noting that these groups also tended to have lower levels of relationship satisfaction as well. Importantly, we also found that men who are classified as having some sort of functional difficulty and or disability were also more likely to be less socially connected than those without difficulty or disability. For example, they were less likely to be employed and they had significantly fewer close friends and relatives on average than men without functional difficulty or disability. Briefly, we also found that certain life events might affect our feelings of social support. For example, experiencing difficulty finding a job in the past year, leaving home for the first time, and recently experiencing serious conflict with a family member were all related to having lower feelings of social support. But I get, in terms of some positive take-home messages, we did find that both volunteering and involvement in sport or hobby clubs increased levels of both self-perceived social support and personal well-being. So that's that community integration element there. And interestingly enough, but also probably not too surprising when I think about people like my dad and his mates and my mates, rates of involvement in volunteering tended to increase with age, whereas we saw the opposite with involvement in community-based sports and hobby groups, which tended to decrease with age. So that's a rundown of the main findings for you, Sean.
That's great. Thank you, Brendan. That's a snapshot of some very detailed and really important work. So thank you for that. Ian, if I can shift over to you, does this, the sort of things and the issues that Brendan's raising, does that resonate with you and what you see in your clinical practice?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I guess I would say at the top level, a lot of what comes out of that report is certainly reflected in the clientele that come into a clinical setting. And I'll mostly today talk about my views from that perspective of client-focused work in the mental health context. And of course, there's nuances between individuals in terms of, you know, pathways to disconnection and also the extent to which that's impacting on their mental health. So, you know, the way I kind of view it when it comes into practice is that, you know, while social disconnection and mental health are strongly linked, the nature of the link varies a lot. And, you know, you can have disconnection occurring as a result of a mental health disorder, certainly as symptoms of that disorder worsen. If you think about something like depression, where motivation to engage is, you know, reduced, or even social anxiety disorders where, you know, when they're really heavy and they're quite profound in terms of the symptom profile, people naturally disengage from both one-on-one conversations with people, but also community type settings. But disconnection, you know, another sort of space that I see it in the clinic is that it occurs as a result of life change. And usually in an acute context or an acute period of time where there's rapid change in a life, people can often find themselves in a position where they're disconnected. And usually I see this quite often in the context of family changes. So where there's a separation, for example, you know, a key source of connection is the family unit and the connections to that unit. And when an individual, and in this case, you know, when I work with men, when that separation occurs, and particularly when, you know, they move into separate housing and the parenting becomes different, then what I often find is there's a whole lot of time that guys have that they didn't have before. And I think it is in that space that they start to realize that, you know, I'm not really doing anything here. You know, I'm sitting down watching TV or whatever else. And so there's this thread of disconnection that's there as a result, or, you know, as one of the complications that follows on from sort of a breakdown. But, you know, I also think the disconnection itself, and I think with the 10 to men, you know, there was the bi-directional sort of pathway. You know, if you are disconnected for other reasons, your mental health does decline as a result of it. It may not necessarily be as strong directionally as the other way. But, you know, you see this, for example, in people with naturally introverted traits. You know, if they just find that they like their own time more, they may be less connected than otherwise. And also neurodivergent clients, so autistic clients in particular, who may not necessarily desire connectedness or be necessarily highly skilled in how to do that in a neurotypical way, then, you know, can have a symptom burden that comes on down the track. So it's fairly diverse, I guess, and even physical and other disabilities sort of impact on that connectedness. So when a client comes in, you know, you're thinking about all these factors of what's going on. They generally don't come in with a view that, hey, I'm socially disconnected, what are we going to do about it? But from a theoretical and case formulation perspective, we're thinking about these pathways in terms of what's going on.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, and I think some of those issues that you raise are a perfect segue to our final guest today, Peter. Peter, from a Shedder's perspective, is your sense that many of the men who are joining your groups are looking to increase their social connectedness?
Thanks, Sean, and without a doubt, that's the case. We're here in the Hunter Valley in New South Wales, and we're not that far away from the headquarters of the Australian Men's Shed Association that's based in Newcastle. And the aims of AMSA, those aims include a number of things, but a couple of them is that sheds need to address mental health issues and also to relieve social isolation. It's been proved, as Brendan said earlier, that social isolation is a key and a contributing key to poor health and well-being for retired men, which is what the base of my membership is. And men's sheds certainly provide a space, a place for men to come in and connect and find a purpose in a relaxed and very interesting environment for many of them. It's quite noticeable that opportunities to meet people, new people, as we get older, it gradually declines. But sheds can fill that gap. So men from all walks of life can build very strong bonds within the shed, and many men would not have crossed paths with some of the other men had they not joined a men's shed. They would have been completely non-alert to what happens in those areas. So, again, endorsing what Brendan said, staying socially connected is linked with lower rates of anxiety and depression. It prevents a loss of purpose in their lives. And by coming to the shed and doing things, it actually does give them a higher level of self-esteem due to their not only their own support, their own contribution, but also because it contributes into the community as well with what they do. The other thing that's perhaps often overlooked as an issue of poor health is loneliness. And there are so many men from where we are. We've got a lot of outlying villages on the outskirts of Cessnock, and there's nothing there except residential areas and perhaps the odd club or pub. So having nobody to speak to, or their wives want to get rid of them perhaps somewhere else, sure enough, send them to the men's shed. And that does relieve loneliness for a lot of the fellows. Yeah. There's no doubt that from what has been said to me from some of the fellows who have joined and have spent time at our shed, that it it's been a wonderful thing for them. It extends their social connections. It's quite evident that that works for them, as it works for us and the whole movement. No doubt about that.
That's great, Peter. Thank you for that. And I should acknowledge, too, the success story that is the Men's Shared Association, not just here now in Australia, but also globally. And what, you know, essentially started as a grassroots organisation has spread and is having impacts across the world. So we've got a lot to be proud of here in Australia. And we thank you again for joining us today. So I just want to shift gears now and move maybe more towards the clinical space and in particular ways to engage socially disconnected men. So Ian, if I can throw that to you, can you give us a sense of the types of clients you see who have the highest levels of social disconnection?
Yeah, I was sort of trying to think about this before the webinar today because, you know, as I said, most people don't come in and report disconnectedness as an issue necessarily. But, you know, I would estimate probably, you know, 50% or more are experiencing disconnection in some context. And, you know, as Peter brought up, loneliness as a factor, you know, that becomes a real driving factor of mental health burden in over aging, particularly as people disconnect from networks. But I also think that you can be connected and lonely, all right? So connected on face value. And I think in the clinic, this is what we sometimes see. So you can have people come in who have a network of connectedness, but there's no depth to it, or they don't get from that connectedness what they necessarily want. And I find that, you know, mostly you'll often see this in guys who come in who are busy with work, busy with family, busy with, you know, various responsibilities, and they see a lot of people, and on face value you say they're connected, but at a depth level they're actually not getting much out of the connectedness experience in terms of what they're seeking. So, you know, I'll see people who come in who are seemingly well connected but aren't, but I'll also see people who come in that are very disconnected, and that can be for a whole range of reasons. It's either because I've withdrawn, because I've struggled to make friendships, because they struggle to maintain friendships, because they have, you know, relatively toxic environments that they may be in. So if you're in, you know, for want of a better word, dysfunctional environment or dysfunctional family, then you're not necessarily getting much return on your connectedness there. But also, you know, if we look at it, clientele who come in with substance use disorders, then the connectedness that they have is often not very good either. And it's part, obviously, part of a maintaining problem in terms of that connected environment. So, you know, the type of clientele I see is so diverse that, you know, they're probably the two main categories are either, three would be following a life event like a separation or a workplace change, subsequent disconnection from networks they had, people who are too busy for valuable connection, or people who are really quite isolated in a loneliness context. And then it's, you know, trying to flesh out how they got where they're at and where do we go from there.
Yeah, great. And just to follow up on that point, I mean, you know, a large portion of our audience today will be either clinicians or practitioners. So how do you go about starting conversations, you know, around these issues of social support and engagement with the men when you think it's necessary?
Yeah, I mean, I guess from, you know, my stance as a clinician, I'm always looking at factors that are contributing to what's going on that the client may not necessarily be themselves aware of. And in that context, you know, when a client comes in and they're talking about a particular symptom burden, then flipping that conversation to social connectedness takes some finesse. And so it's not necessarily something that they would naturally drive into a conversation, but we're always looking at opportunities to do that. And you know, there's a whole range of sort of, I guess, Socratic questioning styles that you can use to just sort of encourage some internal thinking around that space. And often I'll say to people who are, you know, quite busy, they may be in a relationship, they may be parenting, but they may be feeling, you know, disconnected. You know, one of the questions that we start to ponder is, you know, something along the lines of, you know, who are you outside of being a dad, a partner, and an employee? You know, and most guys will say, I don't know what we're talking about here. But it creates a space where you can start discussing, I guess, the quality of relationships that they have, the frequency of contact that they're having, what's been disrupted in that space or not disrupted, and where they might want to go with that. But you know, whenever you get the opportunity to reflect on connectedness, my goal is to do so. So if I hear about someone who's spending a lot of time on their own, you know, I might reflect that it sounds like they're spending lots of time on their own. What's that like for them? You know, we're pointing out that isolation and loneliness in that context may be a driver of what's going on. So it takes some finesse, but I think the key part is that as a practitioner or anyone, even in Men's Shed or elsewhere, you need to go into it purposefully. You know, even though the person you're talking to may not have registered that as a factor in terms of what's going on.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that's some amazing insights, and I can only imagine that will be of use to those who are joining us today. And speaking of those of us who are joining today, just as a reminder, if you do have questions through the course of these discussions, just to throw them into the chat. I can already see some live questions are popping up. That's great. We'll get to them in the Q&A section shortly. Peter, if we just shift to the community setting now, I mean, do you feel that many of the men who initially join up to your organizations are struggling to connect with others? And I guess the second part to that is what are some of the strategies you employ to help them overcome those barriers and that resistance to connection?
Sean, certainly we've got a diversity of membership and different styles of fellows from different areas. How do we maintain our membership? Well, we have word of mouth is the easiest way for people to join the Men's Shed. Rumours, they read about it in the paper or in the media. Often we get referrals from Centrelink, job agencies and GPs make referrals suggesting to the men that it'd be a good place to come in and join the Shed and perhaps get something out of it. Often the hardest part for members who may be struggling a little bit in their life, the hardest part is for them to walk through the front gate. We've got an acre of ground at our shed. It covers a whole range of activities, and it can be rather scary for somebody to get to that gate and then see so much activity going on, and they've got to walk through that gate and make contact with somebody anticipating perhaps joining. What I try to do, particularly if they ring beforehand, is to ask the man if he'd like to come in on a day that we're not open. So I can walk around with him in a quiet time. And often these fellows are feeling pretty down and struggling a little bit. If they can come in on a day where there's nobody there, I can show them around and they can see everything they like, which breaks the ice and makes it a lot easier for them to come in the next day or so when the shed's open, and they can settle in and go through the routine. As Ian said, the contact that you have with them has got to be relaxed and friendly. And while our gate's always open, showing them around, giving them a tour, showing them the activities that are going on makes them more relaxed. We do have a 5-minute video that we show to them as well as one of the resources that we use. It's an induction video, but it does cover more than just induction. It does cover things about safety, interactions, expectation, general procedures that you'd normally have at a shed. And that most certainly puts them at ease and gives them a certain level of comfort. We're all volunteers at the Men's Shed. There's nobody paid. So they understand that, and we also emphasize and don't expect to put too much on them from day one, but we do emphasize that they've got to choose what they'd like to do when they come to our shed. And to give you an example, we've got two woodworking sheds. We've got a metal working shed. We have a recycling project with old air conditioners. We've got a vegetable garden growing veggies for the men. We've got a native plant nursery that we sell products commercially, but we also have a coffee club and a table or two where you just sit down and have a chat. So there's plenty to do, but they've got to decide what to do about it. We don't push them into anything. We allow them to seek their little spot and perhaps a comfortable place for them to work. some sheds have a buddy system as a resource to help the men settle in, a shed mate as we call them, and that can be really, really helpful in a two-way street, not only for the new chum, but also for the person that we've appointed as the shed buddy. It gives them some interaction with the new member and gives them some confidence in talking and mixing and all that sort of stuff as well. There is always a range of manuals and health books and handouts, but the best strategy that we can possibly use for a new chum coming in is just to talk to others. And it's a trait, has been mentioned earlier, that men sometimes don't do enough of, is just purely sitting down and talking. And you'll find that there's a common interest there between some of the men who have had that operation or that stent installed, or they've had a depressive state, or they've got some other illness that is like-minded with somebody else at the shed. And then they can find that they're not alone and they can talk about it openly with a great deal of confidence. It works for us, and it proves I've got over 100 members at the shed. When they come in, they'll just get lost in that 1 acre of ground with the various sheds and activities that we have. And so it's not really that scary for anybody to do it, because they're not all congregating in one area. It works for us.
Yeah, absolutely it does. And we should acknowledge too that community organisations such as yours are often at the forefront of work in this area, and actually kind of help to inform the research program and where we sit from 10 to Men. You know, we'd like to continue to work with the Men Sheds group to make sure that we can take learnings that you've got on the ground and also work together to make sure we can, for our future programs, continue to sort of refine our research programs in this space. So thanks for that. We are unfortunately rapidly racing through our discussion points today, but we did want to finish off today's discussion amongst our panel members by talking about some of the impact and implications of this increasing amount of research and clinical work around social connectedness and the community work that Peter's just alluded to. So Brendan, in line with that, can you talk us through some of the implications that came out of your recent work with 10 to Men for practitioners?
Sure. So as we've talked about today, given that a relatively consistent finding throughout our report was that older Aussie men appeared particularly vulnerable to being socially disconnected. I mentioned this earlier, obviously all of us have talked about it. I think it's really important to focus on addressing this. As we all know, because we're lucky enough to have Peter chat with us today, services like Men's Sheds can help address it, but I think encouraging men to take up opportunities for physical activity and other types of social engagement in contexts that might be accessible or incidental might be a feasible and low threshold means of enhancing social connectedness among this group. For example, promoting sports or exercise participation in workplace environments, if available and if applicable. One important thing to note is that interventions to improve social connectedness don't have to be intensive in-person experiences. For example, one recent study showed that a semi-regular Zoom intervention helped reduce loneliness and depression among both older males and females. And given what many of us have gone through over the last couple of years or more, it's important to acknowledge how beneficial remote contact can be for social purposes. Just to touch on an area that I'm passionate about, I think that's important, is acknowledging the need to improve social connectedness among men who have functional difficulty and or disability. Again, this might include access to digital platforms and social media and other online mechanisms, but community participation among this group can be aided with improved access to assistive technology and support, and also transport. But also improving opportunities for people with difficulty or disability to enter the workforce and remain in the workforce, including creating roles and tasks within organisations and businesses that suit people of different capabilities. Lastly, I just think that many men, as we've touched on today, still experience apprehension in accessing services or official support systems for low social connectedness and other health issues. So it's about continuing to combat the stigma and the low health literacy associated with that, and being mindful about the interactions that men have with the healthcare system and social support systems, and the barriers that they may face in doing that.
Yeah, thanks, mate. I think that's a really good insight for our audience today. And again, I'd encourage them all to download your report and read into some of that detail that you've raised. Unfortunately, given the limits of time, we haven't been able to touch on it all, but it's certainly an area that we'll continue to focus on. So thank you for your efforts in that space. Ian, can I just ask you, I mean, one thing that seems to be coming through in the live chat is this issue of gender for practitioners and whether or not, in your experiences, men prefer men or women. I mean, do you have a take on that?
Yeah, it's you know, a question that's sort of been floated around even in academic circles for quite some time. And for the most part, you know, probably 70 to 80% of guys don't have a preference when it comes to gender of the practitioner. And around, you know, sort of 10 to 20 either way, you may prefer male and some prefer female. You can also get variability within an individual, which is that depending on what the pressing issue is, then I might want to speak to a female or a male versus other issues where, you know, there's no concern around that. So, you know, I think that if you are a clinician or a healthcare worker or a mate or someone at Men's Shed or, you know, at a sporting club, it really doesn't matter, you know, the gender dynamic of the interaction. What matters is that you approach it from a gender-informed lens, I guess. And one of the things I note with guys is, you know, there's the misconception that men don't like to talk, and I call it a misconception because it's very much how you talk. And it's very much where you talk. And I think Peter picked up on some of that before in terms of allowing guys to choose areas, tasks, people, you know, and creating environments that fit individuals. In a clinical context, it's the same sort of thing in terms of creating a space that men are comfortable in. And if you're driving direct question, hard questioning, specific questioning, you're not reflecting and you're not listening well, then men will just disengage from the conversation. So a gender-informed approach is really just thinking about, you know, what's the nature of this individual that I'm talking to? Can we talk indirectly about issues that I might think are coming up, like social connectedness, for example? And I sort of mentioned a couple of ways that you can indirectly throw in some conversation around that. But specifically, if there's clinicians that are concerned that they're not a fit for the client, then I would say your client either wouldn't have come or won't come back, and then you'll know. But for the most part, we shouldn't go into interactions concerned that there's a gender mismatch.
That is great, Ian, and I know that that is an issue that I can already see is regularly coming up, and I think there's some great insights into how to best approach those. Another issue that's often sort of come up is this issue of how we deal with culturally diverse people or people from rural or regional areas. So perhaps to Peter and Ian, is there any ways, Ian to you first, is there any differences in the ways that you work with men from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the way is always a client-informed way. And if I'm not sure on the cultural background of an individual and how it impacts connectedness, you know, we always enter conversations around that. I've been working with someone who's come over from the Middle East over the last sort of 4 or 5 years, and they're very well connected, but the quality of social connectedness isn't great. But I'm seeking to understand the kind of cultural dynamic that sits behind that in order to help this individual flesh out ways forward. So I think it's never a one size fits all. And I think that's both within a culture, but also across cultures. And I think having that flexibility to kind of flesh out what's going on for the individual, what are the contextual and environmental and cultural factors that are impacting them, it's very much a process of shared discovery. The client probably actually hasn't thought about it extensively from those lens, through those different lenses, and neither is a clinician. But I've never had an experience where I'm actively trying to learn about these things from a client where that's been met with a stone wall. You know, these guys are happy to talk about it. And so if you're not, you know, particularly skilled in working with a particular cultural group, or a particular orientation elsewhere, then ask, you know, learn. The client knows that best, and they're going to give you the info that you want if you're genuinely open and willing to learn about that. in terms, I would say for the rural and other factors, it's the same. You know, what is the contextual environmental issues that that person faces, and how is that interacting with the disconnectedness? And you know, I think that's an opportunity to throw to Peter, because how do groups like Men Shed feed into, say, rural and remote areas, and do they?
Well, exactly right. Peter, over to you.
Yeah, I can certainly comment on that, because we're a regional city of about 60,000 people. And as I mentioned earlier, there are a lot of outlying villages around as well. The majority of the residents are local, and they've come from a coal mining background or an associated sort of an industry. They're blue collar workers, they're tradies, or they've got a rural background, as you mentioned. And that's grape growing, it's grazing up the valley further, it's the horse industry. It's interesting that a lot of those fellows have worked with a team, or they've had workmates in their life, and so leaving that can be a real bummer for them, and they do find suddenly they need to do something else. Mm-hmm. By coming to the shed, they fall right into that category, and we quite frankly have a mix of people with Indigenous backgrounds. We've got others who come from a disadvantaged socioeconomic group. We certainly have a number of men who are disabled or are physically challenged, and we do have a mix of nationalities. But surprise, surprise, once they're there and once they get into the place, they get on extremely well together. And I know, Ian, I'm at grassroots level here in some respects, and seeing a lot of guys from all those sort of categories just getting on famously together, it's remarkable. I have to say, we limit the amount of red tape, we limit the amount of rules and regulations, we don't insist on what they do. We've got tools and materials all around the place, but the saying is, probably the best tool that we have in the shed is the kettle, is the cup of tea, is the coffee pot that's bubbling away all the time. And the guys can come to that and sit around and talk. And we don't say you've got to work from 9 to 5 or from whatever the time might be. They just do what they like and when they like. And while we do have a morning tea break and a lunch break, it's pretty casual and social and enjoyable. And joy is the key.
That's a great point, Peter. And you know, just to echo what I said previously, I mean, within the research space, I think we have a lot to learn from the approach that the shedders take. Ian, if I can just throw to you, I mean, a lot of the kind of conversations in this space seems to be around online programs and online interventions. So how do you see the role of those programs in supporting social connectedness? I mean, are they just as good? You know, are there any kind of particular programs or resources you'd recommend in this space?
Look, I think I don't have any particular recommendations around programs or resources. I think social connectedness is important, and I think there's often been, you know, question marks around whether connecting socially pre-COVID, usually via social media and gaming platforms, whether that was a healthy form of connectedness. And I think we've all had the opportunity to experience that actually online connection is a really valuable thing when it's used and it's fit for purpose. And so social connectedness in online formats is actually, for me, nothing that I would consider to be problematic. I think that there are challenges within that context. So if you are someone who, you know, moves towards hiding in a online platform and connected in a space as opposed to meeting people face to face, that might be problematic. But for a lot of people, the online space is very natural. It's very easy to interact with, and there's return on that when you make good connections with people. You know, in terms of the programs, I think, again, it's got to be something that's fit to the person. If they're looking for a particular thing, you'll soon find whether it's a fit or not, because this guy is just going to disengage from it. But I think it's not really around trying to get the match perfect the first time. It's around repeating the process. So when you're, you know, sort of as Peter pointed out, when you have someone come into Men's Shed, you allow them to pick and choose where they go. And I think the same would be for any kind of online-based intervention or program or platform, we're providing choice, we're providing flexibility, and we're allowing people to find their own fit in those spaces. And I think that's the critical part, rather than forcing people down a particular path or into a particular activity.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's great that those kind of complementary services are now available, particularly, as you say, learning lessons from the last couple of years of the pandemic. Peter, we are unfortunately rapidly running out of time in our panel discussion. Perhaps if we can just finish with a couple of questions to you. So obviously, it's something you've been involved in for a long period of time. Are you seeing a sort of, is there a change in the way that men engage with the Men Sheds programs?
I guess the clientele base is changing. Certainly as our men get older and they're not there anymore, are we filling the void that they're leaving? I think the level of skills that our original, we've been there 16 years, the level of skills that we started with is disappearing. And what's coming up from the younger generation, they don't have that same level of skill. They may be more computer literate to some degree, but basically that's something that's going to be a major problem with the shed movement as time goes on, because it's a practical thing right throughout Australia, right throughout the world. Some of those hard-earned manual skills that are so valuable just aren't there anymore. We try, and the older blokes try and teach some of the younger blokes, they're 70 by the way, the younger blokes, try to impart their information down the line a piece, and certainly some of the guys pick up on it quickly and love learning how to use a chisel or do some wood turning or learn how to weld or whatever the case might be. So that's one of the things that we're noticing particularly. Whatever happens at the shed and whatever transpires, we always like the guys to leave the shed each day when they go with something that they've picked up on, whether it's the newsletter or whether it's a health handout or a booklet of some kind, whether it's a new friendship, whether it's some information about some of the other members that they didn't know about before. We find that that's valuable, that they've gone out, they've come in on a high and they've left on a high as well by learning something new. That's one of the things that we try to do.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it's I think really important, you know, in this discussion that we sort of finish on a high note, and Men Sheds provides us plenty of those. I mean, I guess, you know, to the last question, what is the secret to the success of the Shedders approach? If we were to ask you to distill it into a 2-3 minute answer, is there something you think we can take away today that you think is essential to increasing social connectedness?
Well, there is a slogan that the Shed uses. Maybe this might be the answer, and that slogan is, men work shoulder to shoulder at the Men's Shed. And if you think about that, they'll come in cold, they'll go to their little areas, they'll get into it, and they're working away shoulder to shoulder with that level of enjoyment. Simple as that.
Beautiful, beautiful. All right, I think that's a great note to end for our panel discussion. As I alluded to earlier, a very exciting part for us is the Q&A with our audience. And I've been able to check as those questions are streaming in. There are lots of those. Unfortunately, we're a little bit limited for time, but we will try to get to them, as many of them as we can. And this is a question I'll put to all of you, but it touches on what Peter just spoke about in terms of working shoulder to shoulder. I mean, as we are starting to emerge back to some sort of normality, one of the questions that we got from an audience member is, what are some tips for identifying men who may physically have a lot of people around them, but aren't really kind of getting that level of social connectedness or aren't getting that quality of social connectedness? So this is a question to all our panel members today. So feel free to jump in at your leisure.
Well, if it happens at the shed, we give them a job.
Sure.
I've just sprouted off earlier that we don't allocate jobs to anybody at our place. However, if there is somebody in that scenario, if they're feeling like a bit of a shag on a rock, we'll say, Ben, come over here. How about giving us a hand with this? and then they'll rally and they'll endure themselves. And I guess it's a matter of noticing and exercising that activity.
Yeah, great. And I mean, Ian, do you have any kind of insights in terms of clinical practice? And obviously this is a relatively new phenomena, but people may be, you know, in urban regions surrounded by millions of people, yet still feeling that kind of contradictory disconnection from real quality kind of connectedness.
Yeah, it is. I think it is an issue, and it goes back to that kind of idea of, is quality social connectedness represented by the quantity of connections, or is it represented by the quality within those? And my view was usually the latter. And, you know, sometimes I've come back to really thinking about, you know, at an individual client level, what do they value in terms of just living generally? Now, what sorts of values does a person hold? And recently I was working with someone who sort of valued justice, fairness, and they were kind of found themselves in a circle of friends that didn't really hold the same values. They were quite defamatory about particular groups of people. The way they talked about certain things was not a fit to the individual. And, you know, we sort of gradually came back to this notion over time around, this individual is well connected, they're succeeding in life, they've got a good family, but there's something missing. And, you know, we spent a few sessions actually unpacking what would be inequality connection, what would be inequality friendship, are the ones that you currently have fitting the criteria that you want. And for the most part, the answers were no. And so it's really about thinking what is, and I often talk about return on investment with clients, because you're investing time, you're investing energy, you're investing an attempt at connectedness into other people. What is your return? You know, obviously we want a positive return. And if that's missing, then what are we going to do about it? How do we go about it? Do we approach the current connections and friendships in a different way, or do we find new ones? And that's another whole challenge, but sometimes the conversation swings that way. So I would say that in the end, you just get a sense of a mismatch almost, you know, in terms of what the person wants in their life and the qualities and the values that they hold and desire and what they're actually living. And so we're thinking mostly in that context around the contextual factors that are driving behavior or that are not driving behaviors.
Yeah, great. I mean, it's obviously a new and emerging space, all the areas, and, you know, it's something that obviously we are going to start to pay more attention as we go along. If I can put my researcher hat back on for a little while, this is another question that's come from our audience to everyone, but it's around evaluation. So a lot of these programs that we've spoken about are getting an increased amount of attention both from government and from research groups. So what are the outcome measurements we're recommending, or do we have any recommendations for evaluating success on whether these programs in the community and elsewhere are contributing to improved social connectedness? So again, open to all. If you have some thoughts on that, it'd be great to hear them. I guess the question is really, what's our indicator of success for these programs, and how are we going to sort of benchmark some of these programs as more and more are emerging against each other?
Okay, I think it's variable. I think you could launch a program that's designed to reduce mental health burden, for example, and you know, you would pick mental health related outcomes in that context, and you may not see much of a change, or you might see a fragment of change. And that's because there's a whole range of other outcomes that are important. If I was looking generally at, you know, your general male population in terms of how these programs are working, I would be thinking more things, more measures around, you know, general well-being, quality of life, perception of, you know, quality of social connectedness, because, you know, all of those things are going to change in a kind of relational way. And I think it's about getting a sense of what's the breadth of change that we see in a program, rather than trying to single out a particular factor. Although the complication there in the research space is, if you're doing clinical interventions, you should really have one or two primary outcomes. And I think that's the bit of the trap in terms of evaluating these programs. But I think, you know, we can throw out a range of factors that we think are going to move in line with someone's engagement in a program or a service if we're evaluating it, and, you know, cast the net wide, learn the ingredients that are working and the things that are changing, and then narrow it down as we develop new programs that are designed to tackle a particular factor or a particular area, in which case we would narrow down outcomes related to that intervention.
Yeah, great point, Ains. And Peter, I guess, can I ask you, I mean, I know part of the magic with the sheds or the shedders was it works because it works, but clearly as they become more and more successful, both nationally and internationally, what's the kind of Sheds Association approach to engaging with researchers, with government, to sort of start to get engaged in these evaluation processes?
Well, we're certainly open to that. AMSA, the Australian Mental Shed Association, is certainly partners, not only with this organisation that we're in today, but also with a number of other government and semi-government organisations, and widely are open to that sort of an influence. We are federally, at that high level, at AMSA level, they're federally funded to maintain the interaction with the sheds that are throughout Australia. And I might add, as you've mentioned, they're overseas as well extensively now. When we first started, we started with 8 people. We eventually, there were 100 sheds in the area. Suddenly throughout Australia, there's 300. All of a sudden, there's 1,000. I guess by that, you can indicate that certainly there is a level of success in the men's shed movement throughout Australia and overseas, where it is also extended. We make the statement, which is a bit frivolous, that there are more men's sheds in Australia now than there are McDonald's outlets. While that is frivolous, it bears some measure of indicating the success of how it's been going through the 20 or 5 or so years that it's been running. That's what I can measure.
That sounds pretty successful to me. Thank you, Peter. Brendan, Ian, do you have anything else to add?
Brendan, did you have any thoughts on that from an outcomes perspective, having looked at, you know, Tendermint data, for example?
Well, I agree with a lot of the things that you said, Ian. I think there's so many different mental health and wellbeing outcomes that you can look at, and it can depend, you know, on what the aim or the objective of the or objectives of the initiative is. One that we looked at briefly for when we were writing this report was the Australian campaign Neighbour Day, which had a look at enhancing community. The intention of that was to enhance community involvement and social connectedness among the general community. Back in 2019, they did surveys with 400 hosts of neighbourhood events, and they had a look at neighbourhood identification, which they found was significantly increased among those people who did participate. But for me, one of the key outcomes would be repeat participation. You know, it's fair enough to have people rock up for one or two events, but are they actually still there 6 months later, a year later, or however long you want to have a look at it? So I think for me, that'd be one of the key outcomes.
Yeah, that's great. And just as a technical note, we are trying to get Peter's audio back. I hope he can hear us, because a lot of the questions that we are getting through are about the Men's Sheds program. So hopefully, at least from today, Peter, you do see an uptick in your membership. Guys, Ian and Brendan, I mean, one of the regular questions we're getting here too is around FIFO workers. So obviously, that's a relatively new paradigm. Ian, from your experiences, have you found that men kind of become socially disconnected from both their friends and even their family through this kind of work approach?
Yeah, it can be a real challenge for some of these guys, and I suspect, you know, females who are doing FIFO as well, where, and you know, my brother-in-law is FIFO into the top of WA, and my personal conversations with him are almost that there's a me that's there and there's a me that's here. And, you know, you have a whole range of connectedness that occurs on site. The guys tend to swing in and out on the same shifts. I'll often catch up after a shift, you know, if it's a dry site somewhere for a beer and whatever else, and then come back to normality, as we'd probably frame it, and you're kind of left to pick up a whole range of pieces. And I think one of the things I've noticed in you know, seeing it quite a few FIFOs is it can depend on the swings. So if you're on, I've seen people who do as much as a 10 and 6, you know, you're away for 10 weeks, you're back for 6, to as little as a, you know, 2 and 2. And I think the longer that you're away, the more difficult it is to both come back and integrate into your existing connected environments, but also to fit everything in. And I think that's one of the challenges, because you come, if you're, say, in a family environment with kids, you're coming back into a family and you're reconnecting there, and you're trying to fit all of this other stuff in, you know, maybe one weekend, 1.5 weekends. And so it becomes incredibly challenging. And it is explained as a bit like a pressure cooker at times, because you're either pressured when you're there and you're pressured here, both by time and demand. And it does become really challenging to balance all of the responsibilities and your own well-being in the context of being connected with valuable people.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just yet another example of things we're sort of learning on the fly, and how we as researchers and clinicians need to sort of catch up to this space. I feel every time we have these kind of conversations, we only just sort of scratch the surface and we run short of time. And we've spoken a lot about older men in particular, but of course, as society changes, we have a lot more stay-at-home dads. So how do we support expecting newer experienced dads? They also experience disconnected and isolation, and perhaps even heightened, given some of the other support structures that exist for new and expecting mothers. So does anyone have any insights onto that? Ian, if we can start with you.
Yeah, sure. Look, I think it's, a very disruptive time for new dads as well, in terms of, you know, welcoming a new baby, and the impact of that both on factors like relational dynamics within family dynamics, and also, you know, the usual way of life before the baby is quite profound. I think one of the challenges is, you know, what we might think it's like once we've had a child is never what it is actually like. And I think, you know, there's some real challenges that can come along with that phase for a lot of people. So it can be really disruptive, and it can have a massive impact on you know, the health of new dads in this context. And I think what's important is, you know, thinking about the importance of trying to maintain, obviously within limitations, the way that you did things before, you know. So that's catching up with friends when possible. You know, obviously the frequency of that's probably going to change. Finding ways to integrate, you know, your family into catch-ups with other friends is important. But as much as possible, you know, trying to not just sort of lose, you know, the previous version of you and enter this new phase as a different person. It's like trying to integrate these factors whilst being mindful of the strain of you know, a new baby, both on you, on your partner, and on the dynamics that you're within. It's incredibly challenging.
Yeah, thank you. And it really is. I can speak from experience there. But Brendan, I mean, I know we briefly touched on this on the 10 to Men report. Have you got any insights there?
For fathers?
For fathers, yeah. Like at that particular point in time,
We don't have anything for new fathers. The right. One finding that we did have was that single fathers had a greater likelihood of having low levels of self-perceived social support compared to non-single fathers.
Right, that's good enough. I think we'll come back to you a little later. Right, another question we had was from a lot of our practitioner audience around what to do when men sheds isn't available. I mean, we've spoken a lot today about men sheds, and quite rightly so. But Ian, do you have any kind of suggestions of what we do when a program like a men sheds isn't available?
Yeah, look, Google is your friend. You know, I never thought that I would spend sessions with clients on the internet finding options, but I think it's completely necessary, because the programs that are available are so variable in terms of where you're located, how well they're funded, whether their space is available, and those sorts of factors. So there's no, you know, Men's Shed is awesome in the sense that everyone knows about it and it is everywhere, but I think there's a big challenge outside of that demographic to have a similar you know, structure that is a go-to for younger males. So it's really, you know, I'm as lost as everybody else in this space from referral options. But what I usually do is think about, you know, what do they like doing? What has this person previously enjoyed doing? And we jump online. We'll look at either, you know, sporting clubs in their area. We might look at other kind of volunteering options that exist. I might look into, if I see someone who likes to game and they're fairly disconnected, in the past, we've found like gaming cafes where you can go on a social night and do things. So I don't know that we always need to find a program as such, but what we're trying to do is facilitate a client to move towards an option, and they'll go there and it may not fit and they'll come back and we'll find something else. But I'm as lost for referral pathways as others, but my approach is really just help the person out, help the person flesh out what options are out there and what we might try.
Yeah, great point. And with those options, Peter, are there any kind of learnings we can take from the MedSheds groups that can sort of can flow on to those options that hopefully more of which will become available?
Yes, it is a difficult answer. And I know that the age group for MedSheds starts at 18, but it wouldn't be comfortable perhaps for a young man to come in. And yet we have had them, and they've got to be comfortable in working around with the old blokes. And on the other side of it, there's a lot of old fellows who don't want to get involved with the younger generation because they're miles apart as well. It is a difficult question, as Ian said, and hard sometimes to have somebody compatible to work with at a younger age. I'm not sure, we've just finished National Volunteer Week here in Australia. And I know that shortly Men's Health Week comes up. And while I can't actually remember what the theme for Men's Health Week is, I believe it's something around the area of support for men and boys. Now, I don't know what's coming out of that. It's coordinated by the Western Sydney University. And maybe there's something on that site, for example, that might allude to what possibly might be around for the youth of this world.
Yeah, it's a great point. They're a great organisation. They are very active come Men's Health Week. So we'd encourage everyone to keep an eye in that space. All right, just our final question today. Again, as we alluded to, we spoke with speaking to Peter about Men's Sheds and others, often about older type men. But of course, you know, here at 10 to Men, we're interested in not just older men, we're also interested in younger men and even boys. So how do we ensure that younger men sustain these social connections after leaving school, or are there any kind of broader lessons to be learned from the research and the literature on that? Brenton, if I can throw to you from a 10 to Men perspective, is there anything that our research is showing?
Our research definitely showed that different types of life events are more likely to occur and impact our levels of social connectedness or social support, you know, depending on your age. So, for example, younger guys, those aged between 18 to 24, were more likely to experience difficulty finding a job and leaving home for the first time. And those two experiences were more likely to have negative impacts on your levels of self-perceived social support as you got older. So guys who are aged 25 to 34, they also experienced difficulty finding a job, but there were also issues with moving house and getting married for the first time. And then as you get older, you know, the men were more likely to have serious conflict with family members. But the one event or the one experience that was consistent across every age was difficulty finding a job. But as you get older, there's those more relational things like having the death of a family member and having a child or a family member leave home as well. But I'd just like to reiterate what Ian was saying before in terms of Google is your friend. I think that just anecdotally, I can't speak to the research here, but Meetup is an online platform that you can just enter whatever your interest is. So it might be hiking, it might be painting, it might be drinking, whatever else. And you can find groups in your local area that cater to those sorts of interests and that you can hopefully meet up with.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, there really are a plethora of particularly online options available to both younger men and older men. I mean, we were talking before about fathering. There is a program, I think, called SMS for Dads. which is targeted specifically at new dads and that potential to lose those social connections. So it's a thriving scene, and hopefully as researchers and clinicians and people in community organisations, we can continue to contribute to those. Ian, just to throw to you, I mean, do you have, you know, Brendan spoke about these kind of life course issues that younger men will sort of transition through. Do you have some sort of experiences in that space?
Yeah, look, I think it is a challenging time, especially, you know, you come through a school system that's, you're seeing the same people 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. It's arguably a little more of a relaxed environment than the workplace might be for some people. And so the quality of friendships that you have in that environment are probably not necessarily what you'll go into, particularly in the workplace. But if you find yourself not in a workplace or not studying or, you know, not engaging in some kind of follow-on activity, then there's a whole lot of time that's created and you don't necessarily know what to do with it. And I think all those, you know, time is a challenge to manage. And particularly as your friends move on and particularly after school, the whole dynamics change. And so there is a risk of becoming more disconnected in that space. I think if you enter a good workplace or if you go to uni and join a social club or, you know, one of their focus activity clubs, you know, they're ways of maintaining connectedness. But I think it's so variable for everyone that there's no one approach to resolve challenges. I think what people need to look out for is, you know, what's going on with an individual at any age. And Brendan touched on kind of, you know, life changes as a key driver of risk of disconnection. And the signs of that in an individual are probably, you know, more irritability, more time spent alone, withdrawing from connections like family that they might otherwise have been more connected with. And so we kind of need to be pretty mindful of the indicators of, you know, a decline in health and well-being in an individual. And then we can go into that space. And, you know, if you're close enough with the person, you might have some ideas around whether this is related to social connectedness or not. But it's really around finding the indicators and implementing, you know, options and what needs to be done once they're there. Because some people will float through these changes quite well and other people will struggle. And I'm guessing the change thing is an issue in the men's shed space as well, with guys entering retirement.
Yeah.
Peter, sure. Do you similarly have life exchange issues with life courses with your men's shed members?
Could you repeat that? I'm sorry, Sean.
Yeah, so often people, the shedders, they are going through changes in their life stage. Is that something that you experience with the shed associations?
Not a great deal. Certainly, we get a lot of attendees who are unemployed, and job opportunities around our regional city are limited. And so that can be a bit of a challenge to them and a challenge for us to do anything about it except make them welcome, look after them, and allow them to spend some time and not be too badly depressed about that situation. I guess that's the opportunity that we come to grips with. Yep. And on another matter that Ian was touching on, it would be remiss of me if I didn't mention for young people, and this is men and women, young boys and girls, that both of the service clubs, the Lions Club and Rotary Clubs, do have young people's organisations. And Apex Australia, which is the young people's service club, still exists throughout Australia in different areas, up to an age of 45, and those sort of organisations are still around and are eager to get young people to come in and get involved for their own betterment, but also for the betterment of the community.
Yeah, it's a really good point. Peter. I mean, we've spoken about some of the, you know, emerging sort of platforms for social connection, but exactly right. There are these legacy institutions that are still around, still active, and still important contributors in this space. So sadly, that again brings us to the end of our allotted time today. I want to thank, first of all, our panel members for joining us today. I really appreciate those their input today and the conversations we've been able to have. I want to thank our audience members for joining us online. One thing that is a recurring problem in the men's health space is once we start talking, we generally run out of time. And to that end, I know AIFS have looking at opportunities to continue these conversations, and the webinar series is part of that. Again, I'd encourage you to join up to their newsletters and various formats. So that's really it for now. Thank you all. Thank you to our panel members. And we'll see you soon in the future. Ciao, ciao.
Great. Thank you, Sean.
Thanks, all. See ya.
See ya.
See ya.